Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
What we've seen, though, from Optus is a callous action by holding a media release at 5:30 on a Friday. They failed to notify emergency services.
The Optus 000 outage due to a software upgrade has raised questions about the reliability of phones in Australia generally. Stay tuned to find out more here on The Wire. But first, following the recent murder of US political figure Charlie Kirk, there are growing concerns about the rise in online extremism and radicalisation leading to violence. Kirk's suspected killer is a 22-year-old man who US authorities have said frequented online communities such as Discord and made reference to various internet subcultures on bullet casings found at the scene. Maeve Groom asked Dr. Imogen Edwards, senior lecturer in criminology and member of the AVERT Research Network at Deakin University, just why these online spaces have a growing reputation for users who harbour extremist ideologies.
So I think gaming communities can help to feed radicalisation in a few ways. Particularly spaces like Discord are sort of occupied by sort of gaming active communities as well as sort of more, I guess, generalist kind of alt-tech platforms like Reddit and so on, can actually lower the entry point for susceptible audiences. Often people don't have to be seeking out explicitly sort of extremist politics to actually encounter those ideas. They're sort of woven into those subcultural spaces already.
How does this radicalisation actually happen online? Is this purely through communication with other people, or are there other things happening on the internet that are influencing young people in particular?
It's rarely just a case of just a single conversation, really. It is that kind of weaving through popular culture, often sort of countercultural spaces as well, on various types of sort of less mainstream social media platforms where sort of ideas which are pretty extreme in terms of their sort of supremacist and exclusionary elements can actually be seeded or sort of floated in sort of more light and humorous ways. And that sort of gives the people who are producing that media a kind of a plausible deniability as well, that it is actually as extreme as it is, but it nevertheless works to normalise some of those views. So I think the role of humour is really important, and also those online communities in particular can be really important. Well, because a factor that they do tap into sometimes is this countercultural community space, but also the sort of isolation and sense of atomisation, we sometimes say, that can be associated with spending a lot of time online and sort of fewer time interacting with peers offline.
And in the recent murder of US political figure Charlie Kirk, the suspected killer is a 22-year-old man who US authorities have said frequented online communities such as Discord and made reference to various internet subcultures within gaming. My question would be, why are young men in particular more susceptible to extremist influence within these online communities?
Young men particularly can be kind of vulnerable as well to some of these extreme supremacist or exclusionary or violent messages. And this is sometimes the case because a lot of society, wider society, is kind of told young men, particularly young white men, and particularly in affluent countries, even if not particularly affluent communities, are sort of told that they should be achieving certain things and have certain, resources and status easily accessible to them. And if they don't have that, then they are more inclined to think that there's something sort of systematically wrong or prejudicing against them. And that's as well because of the normalisation. If we're talking about the far right and the sort of manosphere there, the sort of societal normalisation that men, and particularly men, you know, of a certain demographic, should really be at the top of those hierarchies. So that's one part. There's also sort of a sense of fraternity and achievement which can be achieved through things like gaming communities and also alternative spaces as well, which can feed those, again, quite popular sort of countercultural community appeals as well.
Is anything being done to moderate these online communities to minimise the violence and extremism we have seen lately? Are these companies and platforms able to intervene to stop radicalisation in its tracks?
So there have been some examples of interventions. So, for example, Discord, a popular sort of gaming discussion, gaming community platform, banned basically neo-Nazi-themed servers or sort of chat forums, as they're called, servers on that forum after the events of Charlottesville, which saw sort of a mass kind of extreme right rally in the US, culminating in the murder of a counter-protester. So we do see explicit crackdowns like that. Reddit has also shut down sort of hate-based subreddits. YouTube has tightened its rules as well. So there are moderation efforts from the platforms themselves. There are also conventions as well in different parts of the world which sort of seek to regulate cyber crime, but also sort of extremist cyber activities as well. And they kind of set frameworks that then national governments can choose to implement. Particularly problematic or tricky issue with some of these particularly far-right spaces is what we call the peripatetic nature of the internet. So that's sort of the factor that servers can jump from one locality to another, and that's actually across national borders as well, such as to try to find sort of lax frameworks. So a lot of hate sites as well can tend to be hosted in, for example, the US, and that's in part related to its free speech, I suppose, freedom of political expression, protections in the US Constitution.
Dr. Imogen Richards, Senior Lecturer in Criminology and member of the AVERT Research Network at Deakin University, speaking there with Maeve Groom.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
Optus experienced a nationwide outage that disrupted mobile and broadband services for over 10 hours. During that time, 000 calls from Optus mobile phones failed to connect in three states and one territory throughout Australia. Four people died as a result. Thomas Kutis asked Associate Professor Mark Gregory, leader of Network Engineering Research Group at RMIT University, what technically went wrong during the Optus outage and why emergency calls failed to reroute as they should.
We've learned that there was a update to a firewall within the Optus network at about 12:30 a.m. on Thursday morning. As a result of the update, 000 calls were not connecting from Northern Territory, West Australia, South Australia and portions of New South Wales. And the rest of the network, the normal calls were working as normal. This was the reason why the Optus phones weren't trying to camp on to another network to make the 000 calls.
In your view, what safeguards should telcos have in place to prevent a single upgrade from disabling access to 000? Should it be like any backup systems?
Well, in this circumstance, what we would have expected to see was testing before, during and after the update. I mean, the most important service that the telcos provide is the 000 emergency call service. And this is now the second failure for Optus in less than 2 years. And what we would expect to see that is greater engineering detail to the way that updates are carried out. Now, Optus have committed to 18 recommendations from a review into the previous outage. They've said that 12 of those 18 have been implemented, but it then questions whether or not they've really implemented those recommendations or did those recommendations go far enough. What we've seen, though, from Optus is a callous action by holding a media release at 5:30 on a Friday. They failed to notify emergency services, other organisations and governments, both federal and state, at an appropriate time. And that was as soon as they found out that there was an outage to the 000 emergency call service. To wait until the next day was just outrageous.
So what you're saying is the time, the response that they got was very poor.
Oh, certainly. The actions of Optus were remarkably poor, and we've already seen criticism from state premiers, from government ministers, from senior people in the affected by these outages. The whole situation is wholly unacceptable, and the CEO gave a guarantee when he took on the role after the last outage that this wouldn't happen again. And I note that the Prime Minister has said he would be surprised if the CEO wasn't seriously considering his position. In my view, the senior management team at Optus need to stand down. They need to be replaced with people who understand the gravity of the situation and are prepared to take actions to ensure that this doesn't happen again.
So what infrastructure changes would you recommend to ensure that Australians can always reach emergency services regardless of their telco provider?
Well, we need to ensure that the telcos have staff on hand that understand how to carry out the updates and to ensure that processes are followed. What we've been told is that this was an update being carried out by a contractor, and that's unacceptable. We also need redundancy and we need failover systems. And a failover system is where you've got a second system that hasn't been updated. So if an update fails or causes a problem, you can immediately switch to the failover system and bring the network to a state where everything is working as expected. You would then go and fix the problem that caused the live system to fail. Reasonable engineering practices are not in place, and the telco industry has been self-regulating, if you like, for too many years. And, you know, for the last 30 years, I've been calling for minimum performance standards to be brought in. But the legislation and regulations currently provide too many outs for the industry. You know, yet repeated calls have been unanswered by a number of governments now. And we need to see this change. And I'm hoping that the current government will change the legislation and regulations to ensure that this type of thing doesn't happen again, and that the overall performance of the telecommunications networks improves. So that would mean that the TIO and the ACCC would need to be given the powers that they need to take action when the telecommunication networks do not perform as consumers would expect.
Associate Professor Mark Gregory, Leader, Network Engineering Research Group at RMIT University, speaking there with Thomas Cooters. Hello, if you're listening to The Wire in Wild Scotsman's Country on 4GGO in Gingin, or 7RPH in Hobart, or 3BB in the Gold Rush city of Ballarat. The Trump administration has approved a new drug that can help prevent autism in children. Medical experts have spoken out against this development, stating that there is no substantial evidence to warrant using folinic acid for treating autism. In the same press conference, Trump also claimed there is a link between pregnant women taking paracetamol and babies developing autism. George Popel asked Professor Adam Guastella from the Clinic for Autism and Neurodevelopmental Research at the University of Sydney just what is folinic acid.
It's been used actually to treat patients with cancer. It's also traditionally been used also to treat folate deficiencies. Now, the evidence for folate deficiency in autism is actually very poor. The science around the rationale for using treatment like folinic acid is very weak. But there have actually been a couple of studies to show that when you administer the treatment, it can reduce symptoms of autism, and these are preliminary studies. But there's also been some other studies that have administered higher doses of folinic acid and found that it can potentially result in side effects. So there's lots of work to understand the right dose, the right treatment regime, and actually even if it's still effective. So we are talking about an experimental therapy.
Can we expect this drug to be introduced in Australia?
The FDA commissioner has actually referred to it as a life-saving treatment. So I think there's going to be a lot of publicity. There's going to be a lot of energy in the states around the treatment. The TGA regulates the use of medicines in Australia, and so they'll look at the evidence, and I'll be pretty certain that they won't be approving folinic acid as a treatment for autism. But that doesn't mean that as a result of the publicity and the media, that families won't go on to try to access their own treatments for their children.
In the same press conference, Trump also claimed that taking paracetamol during pregnancy is linked to children developing autism. What evidence is there behind these claims?
There is evidence that pregnant women who later go on to have a child with autism have there's an association between higher rates of paracetamol use in pregnancy and the likelihood of an autism diagnosis in the unborn child later in life. And that association is only an association. There's lots of possible reasons why that association exists. We know, for example, that women who have chronic health conditions or infections and fevers, they're more likely to have children with developmental delays. And there is some science around why chronic health conditions may be linked to higher rates of autism. There may be common genetic underpinnings, or it may be that there's something that's happening in the womb that could contribute. But in both cases, Tylenol or paracetamol in Australia is taken by women as a response to those health conditions, and that's largely why we see an increase in paracetamol use in those women. And so the association exists, but there is actually no causal evidence. There's zero causal evidence that paracetamol is linked to autism. Absolutely, women should not be concerned about the use of paracetamol, small amounts of paracetamol in pregnancy. And in fact, there's good reasons to suggest why paracetamol could actually be beneficial. If you're having fevers and infections and paracetamol helps to reduce the fever and infection, that's not only going to be healthy for you, but it's also going to be healthy for the baby.
How much harm does a claim like this do to autism awareness and the autistic community?
Yeah, I mean, this is an ongoing issue in the autism field. It's like it's a punching bag for quick fix evangelical solutions that give the wrong message around autism. Firstly, that it's something that needs a quick and easy fix, that it is something that can be addressed with simple solutions. The sort of side message here is that parents are responsible also for the development of developmental delays in their children. So there's lots of really bad messaging that this type of publicity contributes to the community. And I think that the idea that autism can be treated with a simple cure is just simply dangerous, because we know that children with autism need high quality supports, a range of different evidence-based interventions, and this type of messaging takes away all of the hard work that's being done to try and support families with a range of different interventions that actually work.
Why do you think the Trump administration is making baseless medical claims such as these?
From a distance and from afar, we can only guess why the Trump administration is making these claims. But I guess the first thing is that Trump made it a part of his campaign that he was going to solve autism by September. It's now September, and he had to come up with a solution. I think every scientist, credible scientist on the planet, was aghast by the suggestion that he would come up with a solution by September. So this has provided him with a solution. The second bit is, it's quite appealing for governments to come up with solutions that are cost-effective for complex problems. And that's exactly what this solution is. It's a simple, cost-effective solution that provides, a straightforward answer for the government and appears to, but will not, address what is a far more complex issue.
Professor Adam Guastella from the Clinic for Autism and Neurodevelopmental Research at the University of Sydney, speaking there with George Popel.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
Lithgow, once a powerhouse of coal and steel, is a city defined by its strong industrial heritage. Now locals and transport experts are pushing to breathe new life into that legacy by reviving the city's dormant railway yards as the birthplace of a cleaner, greener rail industry, beginning with the reacquisition of the locomotive workshops. Susan Hu asked Dr. Michelle Zybots, 2024 Engineers Australia Transport Medal winner and senior lecturer at the University of Technology, Sydney, why is reacquiring the Lithgow locomotive workshops so important?
So the community and council are combined and they're collaborating, and they're asking state government and federal government to collaborate and buy the site from Pacific National. We're now waiting on the government to move on that. It's been a bit frustrating, actually. But the reason why that workshop site is important is because there's a chronic shortage of railway workshop space in New South Wales and other parts of the country at the moment. And there was a very great fear that that site might be sold off to land bankers for real estate development and speculation. And so that's one issue. The other issue is that Lithgow is the birthplace of industrial Australia. It's a coal mining community at the moment, or at least that's how we're perceived. But we're also a big railway community, and the solar train was invented and it was manufactured here in Lithgow. It's now in operation in other parts of New South Wales, at Byron Bay, and there's two vehicles now being exported to Japan. What the Lithgow Community and Council want to do is to see a solar train service that goes from Lithgow out to Kapiti and the new Gardens of Stone National Park, which is beautiful. It's beautiful, and it's bigger and better than the Three Sisters at Katoomba. So what we want to do is enable people from Sydney to come up on those new Marion train sets that are lovely, interchange at Lithgow, or get out and walk around in our main street in Lithgow, which is right on top of the station concourse, and then catch a solar train, which is a train that's got solar panels embedded on its roof, and it's run on a battery electric system. And it does that through non-electrified sections of rail tracks. So it's zero emissions. And they're beautiful old vintage rail carriages that have had this modern technology added onto them. And there are dining cars, and there's beautiful timber work inside, and you can open them and close the windows yourself manually, and, you know, kids can stick their head out the window and have a look and all sorts of things like that. So it's a beautiful way in which people from Sydney could come and have a terrific rail holiday. And we'd like to build those en masse, if we could, in Lithgow, and see them, you know, bring about a kind of railway renaissance throughout regional New South Wales and possibly other parts of the country.
Is this being introduced now? Is it currently being worked on?
We're currently lobbying for it. The community is going to go out, and I think we're going to try crowdsourcing the funding to get the first solar train built that would hopefully operate in Lithgow. We're currently negotiating with the state government, but our priority has been to try and secure the future of the Lithgow Locomotive Workshop site, because we need that workshop space for two things. That's where we would manufacture solar trains, and it's also where we would be able to store the rolling stock when they've finished their runs between Lithgow and Kapiti. But we're also wanting to run solar trains between Lithgow and Bathurst, if we can, because the New South Wales Central West is actually really beautiful, and it's a place that a lot of people from Sydney just don't know about. Everyone knows about the Blue Mountains, but there's another world on the other side of the Blue Mountains, and there's now an opportunity for bicycle holidays and things like that. So one of the things we contend is that, you know, why go to Bali when you can come to Lithgow, which might sound a bit strange. But it's actually quite serious. The country is beautiful, and we think the transport and zero emission transport from Sydney is not very far away at all, you know, into these wilderness areas that are just stunning. I think it is the widest canyon in the world, and there's one point at which the train comes out from a tunnel and then it just grabs you. You know, and the landscape out here in the Central West is different to what it is on the coast, because it's all about the meeting of the sky and the land. There's no sea. And I don't know, there's just something very different. And you get a sense of vastness that you don't quite get with an ocean. It's quite strange. I can't describe it, but it's one of the reasons why I love living here.
Dr. Michelle Zybots, award-winning transport planner from UTS School of Civil and Environmental Engineering, speaking there with reporter Susan Hu. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.